Ron Irwin, you're from Buffalo. Your principal character in the book is from Buffalo. You rode at a private school in Buffalo, and your principal character in the book rose at a private school in New England. And now you're living in South Africa doing wildlife documentaries. Your character in the book lives in South Africa, does wildlife documentaries. It all sounds pretty autobiographical because it's a first novel.
It is. There's a great deal of that element to it. Buffalo in the novel is called Nacalcity. It's a fictionalized version of the city. And I learned how to row here and rode for 3 years before moving on to boarding school in New England. And the events that happened at that boarding school informed the novel. Being from Buffalo, a town I really am very fond of and always have been, life in boarding school was much different than it is here. And adjusting to boarding school rowing was quite a shock.
Boarding schools, especially New England boarding schools, tend to have this image as another planet.
It's true. Well, it's another planet in many ways because back then particularly, you got shipped off to this place way out in the country next to a very, very small, tiny hamlet of a town, and you're there for months on end, and you're living and breathing the concerns of the school. There's no other way to escape it. When you go to even a private school, you know, say in Buffalo, you get to come home at the end of the day and flick on the TV and check in with your parents and check in with your friends and so forth. But that in boarding school, you're always in that little capsule. So the intensity of the life there is what I call a tribal intensity. You start to really be drawn into the traditions and the beliefs of the school, for better or for worse.
My generation in schools like that was before they became co-ed, and obviously your school, Fenton, is co-ed by the time you're writing about the book, but it's always been this other world.
It is, and it's co-ed, and when you get out to that other world, I think for me the biggest adjustment was I went to a local private school here, which I was very fond of, but they didn't want to support rowing. The big sport was hockey or football. And I thought that rowing was this kind of sideshow that I just happened to be very fond of. And I get to boarding school, and rowing rules the roost. It was the sport to be involved in. And that was a major adjustment for me. I thought it would be something like fencing, you know, where it's kind of a sideshow to the main events. But rowing was what our school was all about. It's 100 years of tradition. It's, they had Olympic tryouts there at one point, junior national camps there. It was immensely intense. And I went from thinking I was quite hot stuff to realizing that at the boarding school level, I was pretty far towards the bottom and had a big struggle ahead of me.
The coach of the crew in your book is a guy who a lot of people from outside the hothouse world of the prep school would think is more than a little strange.
He's one of the characters who's based directly on reality. He was a character named Tim Scott at boarding school, and he had this momentous effect on us. And in the early version of the novel, I had many classroom scenes with him, which I deleted because I felt they didn't move the plot forward fast enough. But to give you some ideas of the things Tim would do, he'd been a lawyer, and he'd come stomping into the classroom, and he'd have a bunch of our quizzes in his hand, and he'd say, "Well, you all decided to fail this one," and he'd throw them at us. And he had this wonderful way of, you know, every morning he'd say to this one kid from Burma named Tata Hala, "Hello, hala, hala, hello." And then he'd do things like he had this crazy way of making English literature incredibly relevant. In other words, if you didn't read the New York Times every day, he'd call you an idiot. He'd say that the words are flying around you like bullets, and you people are crawling in the mud with helmets on. Read the New York Times. read books. What we're learning in English class isn't irrelevant. It's not just for academics. It's what the smart people, he always used to say that, it's what the smart people do. They understand poetry. They understand Shakespeare. If you're going to read The New Yorker and read The New York Times, you need to know this stuff. And it made me think that, wow, there's a world out there, a literary world that's vibrant and real. And he was the very strange representative of it.
Of course, as I started to read the book, I got the feeling this was going to turn into one of these pedophile sex scandal sorts of things because of the control, the Channing, the teacher has on the people on the crew. In this case, the four man plus Coxie, God four.
Yeah, you know, it was a that you. Of course, the novel is not about that, but it is about this incredibly close relationship that developed. I mean, I was a diamond in the rough in boarding school. I'm like, there's no way to sugarcoat that. I got out of Buffalo, and I'd had my share of trouble at the local schools here. And he was the tough guy who really showed me that, you know, I could expect more of myself. And lots of people show up to boarding school, and this is the last stop for them. And you need to have a tough, controlling hand, and to take four arrogant 18-year-olds and put them in a boat and make them win requires a kind of closeness that's you certainly couldn't do it in college, for instance. And it's obviously not a physical closeness, but it's a way of kind of breaking somebody down and yelling at them and pushing them and also being part of their life in a way that is impossible in the day school setting.
In the case of the real character that's at the center of the story, not your character, but the counterpane at the center of the story, he's on the old New England path to Harvard sort of thing, and you have the woman who's the girl who was the coxie on the path to Yale. This was the old-fashioned class structure, working your way up through a prep school to Harvard or Yale or Princeton, and then out into the world to Wall Street or to law school. This is clearly what the school is trying to do.
We probably were at the very end of that. And frankly, it still does exist. You still have these old families who have over the years given so much money to these top universities that there's really no way they can turn down the offspring unless they're – well, even if they are criminals or something. And Connor Payne's based upon many people I met in boarding school. And it's, I think it's a very American thing in literature where we really, you know, Fitzgerald brings it to us vividly, where you not only want to be wealthy, you want to be wealthy, so wealthy that you never have to worry about the bumps and grinds of everyday life. And to go to boarding
school. The rich are different.
The rich are different than us. They, you know, of course, Fitzgerald had a big connection to Buffalo. He grew up right around the corner here. And used to come back to this city quite often as a little kid. And, you know, the idea of I'd get there and it was shocking to me to think, wow, here's a guy who not only has all this money, that wasn't really that impressive, but it was they don't even know why they have it. It was from selling molasses to the Indians during the Revolutionary War. It was from deals made in the 19th century. And to even talk about money was seen as so gauche. And to know also that here's someone who has it all and yet is competing so hard as a rower, not because he needs to get into college like the main character does, but because it's the family pride. The family expectations are so heavy upon him. And I think that was something that captured my imagination even as a kid, to have this guy who was funny and interesting but also just a wicked oar and pushed himself that hard even if he did nothing, he'd still go to Harvard.
At the same time, he's seriously disturbed.
He is disturbed, and I think part of it is the expectations of the school and the expectations of his family are kind of the perfect storm. You say to an 18-year-old that an entire school's honor is depending on you. You say to an 18-year-old, your parents really won't like you as much unless you win this race that your father won and your grandfather won and your great-grandfather won. And from one perspective, that sounds very romantic and kind of Ralph Lauren, but from another level, it's a lot of pressure. And there's no such thing in the preppy world as kind of unconditional love. Let's face it. It's the world of you earn your parents' respect. You have major expectations upon you. And they're tribal, strange expectations. We may not need you to go out and make a lot of money on Wall Street, but we want you to win certain races and do certain things and go to certain colleges and marry certain people. And that's almost more constricting.
I'm trying to avoid explaining the key incident in the book. I can leave it to people who want to read it. But there's a massive cover-up of what happened late in the book.
There is, and it's not so much a cover-up so much as it's such a horrible tragedy that what happens is people are really ill-equipped to deal with it. And they rather than get together and have some kind of counseling and work through it, they all go their separate ways in life and live with the ramifications of what happened to them in boarding school. And it's not until 15 years later that they come back and face what actually happened on that bridge at Fenton, Connecticut. And I was very careful when I was writing the novel not to make the school look like it was at fault for this, but to, you know, the school was the setting where these kids played out this incredible tough competition.
But the school, in a sense, was responsible because they didn't do anything about this, about Channing, the coach, the way the rowers were treated on this four-man crew. They could have done something about what was going on and chose to be very hands-off.
Well, yeah, I think that the school, in reality, feels very strongly that the coach has a kind of godlike power over his charges. When I was thinking about the novel, I never really thought, and I find it interesting that you say that, that it was kind of abusive. In fact, a lot of us look back on that treatment quite fondly. The big thing was the isolation.
People look back fondly on Marine boot camp.
Exactly. Well, they do, don't they? They look back fondly on the tough squad leader who leads them into combat, and they come out on top, but you need to go through a certain kind of change. And I think as you've noticed something that I suppose is fascinating, that in schools where there's more parental involvement or there's more control, you just wouldn't want there'd be lots of red flags about the pressure these kids are under. And when they start misbehaving, or as they would say now, acting out, you'd have someone to sit down and discuss it with them and what's wrong and why do you feel such pressure, and maybe they could get to the bottom of it and maybe they could not. But certainly the novel looks at the old way schools dealt with this, which was, you know, demand the best and let the chips fall where they may. I think ultimately they all have a warm feeling about the school itself, but certainly are ambivalent about each other. And I think that that's what happens with rowers. It's a sport, as David Halberstam once said, it's a sport of duelists. It's a sport where you are friends with somebody, but you also want to be better than they are. It's very hard to kind of live and let live in the world of rowing.
Well, you drive down the Niagara section of the Thruway and see the crews that are practicing on the Black Rock Channel, and you sometimes are amazed that you have 9 people in this long floating stick that are rowing in sync.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what got me into the sport. I was driving over the Peace Bridge with my dad. I looked over and there are those rowers, and I thought, man, that looks like a lot of fun. And I just went down one day and said, teach me how to do this. And the first time I ever went out on the water, I was hooked. I was never going to do any other sport. Okay, it was skiing and stuff like that. But I went out in the water with Jerry Jacoby and Matt Broniak and Kevin Connor, and they're probably all here in Buffalo still, and I took one look at those guys rowing and thought, that is me. I'm finished with lacrosse. I'm finished with hockey. I'm finished with everything but this sport. I will do this sport. And I did. I rowed. I thought about nothing but crew for 8 years of my life.
Friends of mine in high school who were rowing, we all thought they were a little nuts because they were, you know, midwinter, they're out running, getting in shape for when the ice breaks up on the river.
Well, you know, you think about sports. You think about a guy who plays hockey, for instance, or plays tennis or squash. There's a God-given gift there. You have to have some coordination, and you need time to really develop a feel for the ball and the ice and the court. Rowing doesn't require that, but it requires a certain sense of will, of fanaticism. Pulling an oar through the water isn't as difficult as a perfect backhand on the squash court. I'll admit that. Skating and handling the puck takes 2 years to learn to do it properly. But at the same time, you have a kind of dedication to the sport that I can't think any other sport could replicate. You really, everybody in that boat is doing the same job. You want to go out there and in all kinds of weather and inure yourself to that kind of pain because you may have to race in it, especially if you're racing in the Northeast. Whether you're in Connecticut or Buffalo, it's the same deal. You may go out in a pouring rain in a boat, and you can't sit there and think, well, I don't like being rained upon. You know, a squash player doesn't worry about that. A tennis player doesn't worry about that.
You went to Oxford at one point, and Oxford and Cambridge engage every spring. It wasn't that long ago. In what's generically known as the boat race.
Yeah, exactly.
Up the Thames, and, you know, it's a great event.
It's a massive event. Now it's a sponsored event, and the race, that's all it's called, is now, you know, it's televised, and it's on the internet, and it's a massive, massive old race. And it's, of course, the Harvard-Yale race at Gales Ferry in Connecticut is a copy of that and just as big and one of the oldest intercollegiate races ever. I didn't race in either of them, but of course I was a big fan. Henley, of course, is another massive. Henley in England is a massive rowing a mecca, as I suppose Henley in Canada. And again, that tradition, that sense of clubbiness, that's another thing that attracted me to the sport. Was, yeah, we're fanatics, and yes, we're out there in the rain and the snow and so forth, but also that sense of tradition, the Leander Club in England, these connections to these, these old prep schools in England and also, of course, in America, makes you feel like you're part of a club that's not based upon, you know, who do you know? It's based upon how much can you suffer. We've all been through this. You know, you may have someone I suppose, again, it's like war, good old war buddies. We've all been through this harrowing experience, and it bonds us forever. I've had letters from people who graduated from college in the 40s and even in the 30s have read my novel and really just, you know, took the time out to send me an email or find me on Facebook to say, wow, you really captured what it's like to be in a boat in a prep school.
One of the interesting things about being a spectator, I had friends who rowed in high school and in college, but you sit on the banks at, for example, the Eastern Sprints, and it's a very fundamental event. It's often it's two boats, nine people in each boat, and everybody's watching these two. If everything goes right, nobody catches a crab with an oar or something like that. It's this supreme competition, just two boats going to a finish line.
Well, it's really easy to tell who wins, isn't it? I mean, unlike cricket or something like that, it's two boats, it's brute force, it's 8 minutes of your life, maybe just under 9 minutes, and you've trained and trained and trained to push that boat over the finish line. And the amount of sacrifice, when you think about a crew that maybe in their season has nine races, and they've trained 6 months nonstop for those. And there's a few head races, but head races are not as important as the sprints, obviously. And that level of dedication puts you, when you're on that start, waiting for that flag to go down. It's amazing to think, and I used to think, every minute I spend in racing, I've spent probably a couple weeks training. And that's rowing. That's the kind of sacrifice you go through to be in the sport.
Thank you, Ron Irwin.